Hi, and welcome to the Inside Out Security Show. I'm your host, Cindy Ng, and I'm joined by security practitioners who will introduce themselves. And our icebreaker question was inspired by an investment blog post about how we spend way too much time in the bubble of our own professions, and we're unaware of how much there is to learn from other fields. So I had our panelists pick a field outside our industry, and please say why you think a security pro can learn from and why.
Hey, this is Mike Buckby. I thought this was a really neat article. And the one that really resonated with me, there was a doctor that was talking about the cumulative effects of small daily habits. I really think that's something that in the IT and sysadmin world is hugely beneficial. That if you can just like learn one small thing a day, or you can make a tiny bit of progress every day, then you look back in a month or two and you're like, it's amazing. Now we have all this stuff automated, you know, or we have all these things, you know, that we understand and have under control a lot better.
This is Mike Thompson, and something that really resonated with me from this article was advice from an accountant that you can lie more easily with numbers than you can with words, because people associate numbers with facts, and therefore they're more gullible when it comes to numbers. And I think this really relates to how some people, not all people, but some people think about computers, and that computers are numbers, computers are machines, they're infallible. You know, it's kind of like hard logic and numbers, but humans built those computers and humans are in charge of administrating those computers. Don't forget the human element. There's still plenty of gaps in all these technology processes.
I'll start off this show by agreeing with Mike. I thought this was awesome, and I feel like we could really almost talk about this for quite a while, because I picked a whole bunch of these out that were applicable. But I think the one that really stood out to me was the one from the pilot that said that 90% of the job is uneventful to the point of automation. 10% of the job is terrifying and requires complex skills and flawlessly calm demeanor. Being in InfoSec, I think anybody who's had to deal with an incident or been on that side of the fence really understands that. Most of the time, things just hum along. We don't have to think about it. But when something goes wrong, that's when those skills really kick into play. So that really stood out to me.
What other ones stood out to you?
Mike hit on the one with the doctor. I think the kind of the corollary to that one was from the dietitian, which was very same. Solutions to problems can be shockingly simple. Getting people to adhere to the simple solutions can be shockingly difficult. And I think we've all seen that in a lot of cases. There are very simple things that sometimes we could do to improve security, but getting to stick to those practices or getting people to buy into them sometimes is a lot more of a challenge. And kind of the corollary to both of those and the pilot one is what the engineer said. Break down complex problems into the simplest series of steps, which again, we look at a lot of these security issues we deal with, and they seem almost insurmountable. But when we start to kind of pick them apart a little bit, we realize that we can take little steps incrementally to improve things over time to meet those goals. I think the danger of that approach, though, is that sometimes we oversimplify things too. We'll take that first step and we think we've tackled the bigger problem.
Cool. Thanks, guys. And for our regular listeners, if you enjoy our show, if you can rate and review our podcast on iTunes, we'll send you a deck of our InfoSec cards that's based on the Cards Against Humanity card game. To learn more, please visit Varonis.com/review. So, according to some researchers and Google, they say that phishing is the biggest threat to users, bigger than keyloggers and password reuse. And they broke down the numbers as such. They found almost 800,000 credentials stolen via keyloggers, 12.4 million credentials stolen via phishing, 1.9 billion credentials exposed by third-party breaches. And if you look at just the numbers, it would be easy to assume that 1.9 billion credentials exposed by third-party breaches would be the most vulnerable. But I also get that phishing is the biggest threat, and you have no control over what your users do. And then not to mention every year we read that phishing is the biggest threat. What does learning about this research report do for you as a security professional? Like, if you were tasked with protecting the company's infrastructure and crown jewels, what would be your next steps?
Purchase everyone a password manager so that, and along with that, help them get up to speed on using generated passwords for every site and service they use. Or something we do at Varonis is we're moving everything over to a single sign-on service to just reduce the number of passwords with better authentication systems.
Why?
you know, this kind of goes back to the first thing we talked about with the dietitian, where they said that, you know, there's very simple things to do that can have a high impact, but getting people to do those simple things can sometimes be incredibly difficult. And, you know, it's very easy to say, oh, you should use a separate password at every website. But when you have like 40 services you need to log into to do your job, and some of them you only need to log into like once a year, it's just not tenable. So this is a way to directly address that, to make things easier for people. And if you can make security easier, it'll get done.
Actually, Mike, I had suggested, this is going off topic a little bit, but as a giveaway at one of our trade shows, I work at the trade show, so I like to go and check out what Spig was giving out at the different events. And I thought one of the really cool ones would be to give out maybe a free subscription or, you know, a couple month trial to a password manager, something that's way more effective than, for example, like a fidget spinner or like a whole bunch of pens at a security trade show. So maybe that's an idea worth pursuing in the future too. But I think you're entirely right in that aspect. If we can give people a means, an easy means, to take some of these small steps, it'll definitely help. Now, in terms of the results of that study, I was a little bit surprised that they determined that the phishing was the most important one, or the biggest impact one. You know, looking at the numbers, I can see where kind of my initial gut reaction is, maybe going back to Mike's point, math can lie a little bit. I looked at the number and said, oh, a billion is more than a couple million. I had to take off my socks and shoes to count that high, but I was able to figure that one out on my own. But I can see where they're coming from in that instance, especially if you fish somebody, the quality of the results you get is much higher at that point. They're actively using that password, and chances are they probably are actively using it somewhere else too, unfortunately. With the stolen credentials, even though you have a lot more to choose from, and attackers might be able to use them for different purposes, brute forcing or running attacks to try different password combinations on different sites, there's a higher volume, but the quality might be less because they might have been from an old breach and been reused. So I can understand that.
Yeah, I think the direct impact of falling prey to a phishing attack, I mean, it's basically confirmed that what they've stolen is valid immediately, right? I mean, you know, you could still steal old credentials or for something that isn't really used anymore. Or maybe that, you know, is for a deceased person even. Like, that's billions of stuff that you have to go through to try and find something valid that you can exploit. While if someone, you know, falls for your phishing attack, it's already verified that you have working credentials, you already have the, you know, confirmed the breach, you know, it's easy to act upon. So as far as efficiency, you're going to see way more damage coming from maybe a smaller pool, but with more direct results than billions of credentials that are, you know, maybe people also, once they know something, if they're able to be made aware of that data breach from credit card information is stolen from some company you've worked with, maybe you've already gone and changed those numbers. While falling prey for a phishing attack, you may not even know you fell prey, right? You've given them all the information they need and you're none the wiser.
Keylogging was brought up in the research report as a risk, and there was a separate article about how a keyboard was manufactured in China, as is a whole lot of other things, and that because they didn't have intermediaries to ensure that the product is developed properly, that this is what happens when you buy directly from a manufacturer rather than from a general marketplace. And initially, it was reported that the keyboard software was sending key presses. And then after taking a closer look, it only sent how many times a key has been pressed, so that perhaps the manufacturer could see which keys it needs to make it more durable. But some say that this violates the user's trust. What's a healthy, intelligent, mindful way to synthesize what's going on here?
I think there's a lot in terms of setting expectations, that you don't expect your keyboard to be interacting with the internet other than what you type, that you think of it as, you know, a device. It'd be like thinking, oh, this pencil sharpener that I'm using in the classroom, you know, suddenly is putting up statistics and, you know, linking my behavior across the internet. It's just unexpected. And I think that's the biggest thing, that if there was something where they asked for it and it was part of the system and it did things, I think that's better. So I think it really just comes down to, you know, being informed about what's happening and being, you know, honest and upfront with it.
I think there's something to be said from purchasing things from trusted corporations. I mean, this is kind of a little known company, so I think you should put a lot of thought into where you're purchasing things. Now, I would probably not think too much about buying a keyboard. That just seems like pretty low stakes, but apparently not. So I might have to reconsider some of my own purchasing decisions.
This is Killian. I'm trying to play devil's advocate a little bit. I can see where they're coming from a manufacturing standpoint, why this type of information would be useful to get real world data on how to improve your product. But going about it this way and kind of recording that is a pretty significant violation of trust. And I can see this being something that will be filtered out in the manufacturing process. So if you contracted out the actual physical construction, the manufacturer would want to do that for reliability testing, of course, to make sure they delivered a quality product. But the end distributor would probably rewrite the software to provide those features without kind of recording it. But that comes back to responsible disclosure. If I'm recalling correctly, and this could be going way back into the archive, we talked about another similar instance where I think it was like the enhanced keys on, it could have been HP or somebody, was doing something very similar. It was intercepting all of the keystrokes to see if it caught the, you know, enhanced key to execute some function. This seems like a similar case where we have some expectation that the device we're using is pretty dumb. The keyboard is there to capture the keys. It's not supposed to be internet enabled, and it's not supposed to be sitting there and sniffing kind of the other things you're doing. But if we think about it, the keyboard is the interaction point for getting information in and out of the device. So it actually serves a fairly critical function in terms of the amount of information it can capture. So it's something to think about. And it's also a good lesson. Don't, I guess, go around installing a bunch of drivers for things unless you kind of have an idea what it's actually doing and you opt into some of the controls.
Well, and you know, I think what's difficult is everything is getting less expensive electronically and everything is getting more customizable. Like, this wasn't the keyboard that was sending it, it was the cloud driver that they have. And the reason there's a separate driver for this keyboard is that it's a cool mechanical LED backlit keyboard. So like the lights change and you can do different stuff with it. You know, so there is like some need for that.
I think I'm most alarmed with the business process. My current building, I see packages from China nowadays where people are just buying direct from the manufacturer and you cut out all the middleman, the distributors, the regulators, and you're just sort of buying direct because, oh, hey, it's a thing that works and it's cheaper. It makes me really nervous. What does it all mean for our society when you cut out all the systems that are in place that are supposed to regulate go ahead.
I agree. And I think we're losing any ability to have responsibility for who's responsible for figuring out this stuff is working and some level of like quality in that, like this Mantis Tech keyboard, it's, you can buy it off of Amazon. It says currently unavailable, but you know, there's a huge problem with even like counterfeit electronics on Amazon where you think you're buying it from a reputable company, but it's really another company that's pretended to be it and cut the prices. And it's just all unknowable. And I think that's what's really frustrating to me is that I think it's unfair to just push this down to the consumers. I don't know what the answer is.
Right. Because we're not the capitalistic overlords controlling every aspect of the process.
I'm trying though, Cindy. I'm trying every day, get a little more overlordy.
So let's talk about the security of new technologies. So let's enlist our imagination so we can talk about how our future might unfold. Here's a silly one where there's a kid, he was able to unlock his mom's iPhone X with his face. And so I'm going to assume that Apple, they'll figure this out eventually. But how do you anticipate this unfolding in the future?
I mean, I think this is very new technology. Obviously, other people have done facial recognition to certain degrees, but not quite like Apple has now implemented it. I think there's going to be some growing pains, but I think this is, honestly, I'm not too alarmed, at least by this case. A stranger unlocking your device is much more rare than your genetic copy offspring unlocking your device with your phone. And now maybe a kid will go hack your phone and order a new video game off Amazon or something from your phone because you have your credit card details saved. I don't know. I just think this is probably, they say it's like one in a million or something like that. Maybe this is that one in a million chance that someone was able to unlock your device because their face was similar enough. I'm sure there'll be adjustments over time. But I'm not ready to, at least based on this one incident, say that this is a really flawed technology. We've had some conversations about the privacy implications of this before, but at least from a security standpoint, I personally am not sweating because this kid looks a lot like his mom.
You know, Mike, you said like one in a million. And I think that's the right way to think about this is not that, oh, this technology is flawed because this happened one time, but you have to look at it in the larger statistical sense. And I think even in these individual cases where there was another thing where someone was able to like 3D print a mask and then do all this stuff and then, use that to unlock Face ID. But the bigger picture is that, you know, this is such a seamless thing that it's going to have more people, you know, locking their phones, more people not having to worry about Touch ID or entering a passcode. And so in the larger set, there's going to be more people secured than less, which I think is a positive.
I'm not going to name names, but I know at least one person at Veronis who's had their phone unlocked while they were sleeping. You know, someone took their finger and unlocked their phones. I think, you know, there's security flaws no matter what the input might be.
No, I found this article and I wanted to harangue Mike about it because of his love for Apple. Generally think that, yes, more security is better than less security or no security, but I think Apple peddles and gimmicks a lot of time. And I just was kind of amused by this, but I think in general, yes, more security is better than less security. But
killing it. I'm not in love with Apple. I'm in love with my own face. So really, I just want to see my face used for more things and more places.
Didn't you ever see that Nicolas Cage, John Travolta movie Face Off? What if somebody puts you to sleep, steals your face, and then goes and runs around and does crazy stuff?
And then there's like doves in slow motion and, exactly, you know, Mexican standoffs and, you know, the standard John Woo tropes. Yes.
I see the doves flying right now out of your mini fridge.
After the Equifax breach, U.S. senators had the former Yahoo CEO, Verizon chief privacy officer, former and current Equifax CEOs testify on how to protect consumers against data breaches and to potentially phase out social security numbers. And I was alarmed they didn't invite any CISOs or at least a CIO. And I wondered what you thought about the security ideas that they came up with and if it would be potentially possible and realistic solutions.
I think the most interesting thing here was the concept of something that expires. Granted, having to go to the DMV every 3 years to renew this sounds like a bureaucratic nightmare, but I'm a little hesitant to involve more biometric data. I know that's probably where this is headed, but obviously a social security number is inherently flawed at this point. So I'm not sure what the solution is, but I do think that the time limit and having to renew it, as annoying as that might be, is the only, you know, logical thing we can do to make this more secure.
I'm encouraged that a lot of these people came together and they started asking these questions. Is there a better way? And I think that is where we need to go. Social security numbers, basically permanent number that identifies you, that was developed in the 1930s, which we still base so many of our functions on today. It was never really designed for all of the things that we're using, that we've kind of built around it. Adding more bureaucracy is never fun, having to wait in the DMV and get your Apple Face ID to scan you at the DMV to generate a new RSA token or something for this sounds like a pain. But I think overall, the fact that you can change it, and Mike is absolutely correct, is imperative. There has to be a better way to handle this than some static number that lives with you forever. Even if you get your credit card stolen, it's a pain, of course, to call the bank and get all that stuff reissued and set up all of your payments again, but you can change it, and that's the point. It's an inconvenience, but overall, I think any change to the system could only be an improvement at this point.
So the final and last question, and perhaps the one that'll impact us most, is that the first digital pill, it was approved by the FDA, where you can take a pill with a sensor so that doctors and everyone the patient approves of can see whether or not the patient took their medication. But it's so much more than that. I can imagine the data about how the patient is interacting with the drug, their moods. It'll hold a lot of promise to improving one's health care and health outcome. But I also feel like the drawbacks can be dire. How do you know that the data is protected and that people who are entrusted with the information won't abuse it, and that you're mentally all there to keep it going in a productive and positive way? And there is something in the New York Times article that just sent off major alarms in my head. And someone was quoted that, you know, they don't have any data that says whether or not the pill will ensure that the patients with mental disorders will regularly take the pill, but that they'll study it right after sales begin. And then I was like, oh my God, that sounds extremely familiar. It's akin to what we're doing with IoT devices. You know, let's put out the product first and then we'll fix it later.
I'm pretty pessimistic about this. Honestly, I think there might be value in fringe cases where there's reasons to track pills being taken and such. I definitely don't think this is something that needs to become widespread. And to me, it sounds like a payday for the pharmaceutical industry. That's kind of where I stand.
Yeah, I strongly disagree with Mike. A little bit of background. a lot of pharmacists in my family, my sister, my sister-in-law, my brother, you know, I've had to deal with grandparents, you know, aging. What a large issue it is sticking to your medical regime. It's really challenging, and having to be the person that gets those little pill boxes and like puts all the stuff in them. And then like, did you take this? Did you take another one? You took the wrong day because you have Alzheimer's, and you're anything that helps is, I want to use a, say a blessing. Like it's that profound to me, because this is a real issue that, you know, people don't take their medicine when they're supposed to. And it kind of goes back to the thing we said, like it's the simple thing that's difficult to get people to do. Take the medicine you're prescribed when you're supposed to take it. You know, there can be lots of weird reactions that are like, oh, you missed it. So then you take two at dinner, but it's, you know, a blood thinner. So now your blood pressure's on. Like, Mike, you're wrong. So
fair enough. I can be wrong.
Wait, no. Before Killian answers, I want to know whether or not, Mike Thompson, you answered from the perspective of a patient, and if Mike Buckby answered from a caretaker's perspective, because it sounds like Mike Buckby answered from a caretaker's perspective. And patients have, in the article and even in my own life, that I've seen patients who are sort of like very resistant to what their caretakers want them to do, and they feel like everybody is controlling the patient when the patient is the one that's dealing with the problem, the disease, the thing that they're struggling with.
I mean, I think I was definitely approaching this from the patient's perspective, but like I said, I think there's value in it. I don't think this is something that shouldn't be done, this whole idea should be scrapped. I just think it should be the right drugs, the right medical cases, the right patients. It should be considered before implementing, rather than be like, oh, this drug just went generic. Well, we're going to make the original version now have a tracker in it so we can keep charging a lot of money and, you know, get, you know, our doctors to keep prescribing our expensive original version of this drug. So that's me being pessimistic. Like I said, I think there's value in it. I just don't want to see it become this, just a fact of life for all pharmaceuticals going forward.
I get what you're saying about the expense. And, you know, certainly I don't want to see people, you know, taken advantage of. There's an inevitable trend to technology. It's that it gets cheaper. It becomes, as time goes on, people find more and more efficiencies, and it becomes, you know, less and less expensive.
So we can be the tiebreaker.
This decide for everyone on Earth, Killian, right now. Which way do we go?
I am the decider. Man, I was really conflicted when I read this, because I both agree and disagree with both Mike's points on this case. I can absolutely see the benefit for people, and you know, I've seen people in my own life that this would be a huge benefit for that exact reason, for tracking the medication and making sure they take it and that they're healthy, because it can get complicated and they can forget and there could be all sorts of other issues in life. So I see the benefit. I think it'll be a huge help for a certain portion of the population. And again, if the system is implemented properly, the upside is tremendous. On the other side, my security brain kept screaming at me, this is just waiting for somebody to abuse it like anything else. The article talked a lot about this being used as coercion in a lot of cases. And I can see where they're coming from. Imagine if, you know, health insurance or, you know, this can sound, I'm going to put my tinfoil hat on, but the government started mandating certain things to track this information, to get this information, to make decisions about other factors in my life based on this information. And that's a little bit scary.
I think there's an analogous technology to this that exists already and that is very close to some of us. There was another person who was working at Veronis who actually just left, but was diabetic and had a hack together, like literally buying PCBs off of eBay, open source software with an Apple developer account for what's called the Loop system for diabetes, which is that it's, you have your smartphone, you put this open source software on it with a developer account because it can't be distributed in the store. And then you have this little PCB chip that runs in a 3D printed box with a battery you put in your pocket that has a Bluetooth connection between your smartphone and an insulin pump and a continuous glucose monitor. So it's like all these devices you carry around, and this Loop system gets your blood sugar and then does some math and then figures out what it should be and then continuously pumps out a little bit of insulin to help you keep your blood sugar under control. It's very similar to this to me, where it's, you know, this drug delivery system, it's put across, you know, for very similar reasons, that you know, with insulin, you know, you take too much, you're in trouble. You take too little, you're in trouble. It's profound. I mean, it's weird to say, like, in this, you know, we're talking about all these dry technical things, but I mean, it really is profound, the change this has made to people's lives. I think you're both wrong. So I'll fight you all.
I don't disagree that the benefits could be tremendous. But again, my security brain, just the abuse is there. And no matter how well-intentioned a system can be, no matter how well-designed it can be, somebody's going to find a way to abuse it. And getting all this data, and we talk so much about aggregating data and making inferences about people's lives from what even could be anonymized data, the benefits, Mike, I'm not going to disagree, are huge. And I think it could be revolutionary, but I think someone's going to abuse this. And I think it can amount to a lot of coercion, where they could put certain aspects of our lives or our livelihood in jeopardy based on what should really be private information if it gets out there.
Well, so, I mean, there's nightmare scenarios. I mean,
sure.
What I'm talking about is like this really great, profound thing. But at the same time, you're saying like, if you could remotely control someone's insulin pump and like, yeah, pay me 6 Bitcoin or I, you know, pump your body full of way too much insulin. Like, oh my God, that's terrifying.
I'm not talking about that. That's not even what I'm considering here. It's not mundane, but just, I don't like the idea of somebody else being able to use something that should be private, some private medical information about me to force something on somebody in life. I see the benefits of it, but what I don't want is for somebody to go, well, we know this information about you that we probably shouldn't, so you can't do something. We can strip you of some other rights or your ability to do something because you're on this medication.
If a patient is not taking their medication or they're treating their own health their own way and it's painful as a caretaker to watch, I just don't think that taking a pill with a sensor is going to help at all. Everybody knows that if you diet and exercise is good for your health, but why don't they do it? Anyway, do we have a tool of the week?
I'll play the mic roll this week too.
Face off.
So the tool of the week, actually, we started off the pre-show by talking about this, but I think we all kind of individually and independently found out about, was it Quad9, an open DNS solution that I think IBM and a few other organizations are putting together, or that's available now. And the thought is, this is an alternative to using your DHCP, I'm sorry, your DNS, it's Friday, it's late, we can cut this
out. Too
many
acronyms.
DNS service. So for those of you who maybe are not quite as familiar, when you go to, you know, look up a website, Amazon.com, if you want to order your mechanical keyboards from shady distributors, you put in Amazon.com, and what it does the translation between that name, the human readable name, and the IP address of the system hosting it in the background, because that's how it's all addressed for the machines. And what it does is, when you send that request out to do the translation for you, it will look at the domain you're requesting and match it up against a list of known bad sites. So sites that might be hosting malware or other attacks or command and control service, all sorts of other stuff. And they're gathering this information from various sources of threat intelligence to constantly update this list. So if you send that request and it says, wait a minute, you know, this is trying to take you to a site that we know hosts malware, it'll block that. So overall, it'll improve the security and hopefully cut down on some of the instances of folks being directed to potentially malicious sites.
Thanks, Killian Englert, Mike Buckby, Mike Thompson, and all our listeners for joining us today. If you want to follow us on Twitter to find some of the stories we're discussing, you can find us at @infosec_podcast. Thanks, and we'll meet up again soon.
Thanks, Byron.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.
Thanks. Bye.
Bye, friends.